Hey there, it's time for Truth About Mark and Stacy and Max and Max and Stacy, Stacy, Stacy.
Yeah, so it's been another uneventful week at the Olympics. I see Mayor Boris Johnson is in trouble again for his Hiroshima comments about the London Underground. So apparently central London is deserted, according to the newspapers, the Evening Standard. And a lot of people were blaming Boris Johnson for those. Remember over the loudspeaker it was saying, warning, during the Olympics, traffic will be very heavy on the London Underground. Please plan ahead of time and, you know, don't take this line through here, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's deserted. Everything's deserted. So now Boris Johnson came out and he said, well, I shouldn't have gone all Hiroshima on the London Underground, whatever. But, you know, people come back. He's like, he has a campaign he's running now for people to come back and start spending money because they are now calculating the exact, like, for example, the tours of the House of Commons. They're losing £100,000 a day because people aren't coming in. Tourists aren't coming in.
Right. That was unforeseen. That the 100,000 people that came to the Olympics is offset by what I saw was a number between 300,000 and 400,000 tourists that have stayed away. So net, that's a big tourist depression. So I think that the bump, maybe the economic bump that they were hoping for, how is that going to materialize? It doesn't sound like it is it?
No, I doubt it. You know, the reason why I stayed away was all the images of the 5,000 soldiers and missiles on the top of apartment buildings. It's like, why would I want to go to a war zone? You know, that sort of corporate war zone. If I'm going to go to a war zone, I'd rather go to Cairo or you know, somewhere more interesting.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. How much of the fall off in tourist traffic is because of people overestimating the crowds, and how much of it is from people who didn't like the image being portrayed of a corporatized, militarized zone? I mean, what you're saying is the whole image of the corporatist, militarized zone was unappealing, and you've stayed away. You know, we were supposed to go there for a meeting. We didn't go because of the Olympics, and because how much of it were just from people who found the whole thing distasteful to have the military protecting drugged up, pampered little lynxes, you know, to jump around for gold medals. You know, it's not the amateur showcase of my youth, you know, from 30 years ago, where you had actual drama of amateurs competing for glory. This is just one big commercial vomit fest, and people don't want to be associated with it, unless, of course, you're a mega brand and you're using it to force feed more corn syrup down people's gullet.
Yeah, two things in response to that. First of all, 30, 40 years ago, during the Cold War, we did have many athletes on steroids, but at least they were all these women that grew mustaches and beards. Remember, that was they were like amateur steroids. They weren't professional high-tech steroids that they're now taking. Mm-hmm. So we want that. If you're going to have amateur games, you need somebody doing amateur steroids. Uh-huh. And the other thing is, yeah, we were supposed to go there for a meeting. They were begging us to come there for a meeting. And what did I say? But why do we want to go there and be hassled by some goons who are going to be on every street corner, like patting you down and checking your ID and fondling you? And why? Why?
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if this is carried over to other places that have rely on tourist traffic as more and more places get militarized and corporatized. People will not be visiting those places, maybe, and then this is another dent in the global economy. Who were we talking to? Oh yeah, Mike Shedlock, who was saying that the demand numbers around the world in the G20 nations are falling off a cliff. So the indices that track demand, you know, for stuff. And, you know, in the economies like the U.S. is 70% consumer, I think the UK is close to that. Same thing in most of the G20 countries. And so if you don't demand stuff, if you're not buying stuff, you can't get any of this so-called economic growth. Real estate in America, it has been, you know, what I suggested a few weeks ago is coming to pass. You know, I was saying that the crash of 2008 as a result of the real estate crash, then you had the monetary stimulus and bailout programs that gave us a dead cat bounce in 2009, followed by now resumption of the primary downtrend. And real estate has caught up to that stimulus, but now it looks like it's rolling over again. So there's talk about different markets in the U.S., real estate markets in the U.S. not necessarily recovering, but entering a bubble phase, because the banks still have millions of homes on their inventory that they're not really clearing out of their inventory. And some of the bigger markets are still in a downtrend. Hey, what about Ireland? I was just reading David McWilliams' latest on Ireland. Apparently, the economy in Ireland is really now, the rate of collapse is picking up speed.
No, I didn't even hear that. I'm going to go over to the Irish Times or one of those papers and check out the front headlines. But yeah, one company in particular that Mike Shedlock mentioned was Bosch, who is but they're also the largest auto supply parts manufacturer in the world. Mm-hmm. And even Bosch, who, you know, the German conglomerate that also manufactures loads of other things, all sorts of home goods products and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Well, they're, according to the headlines on Google News, you know, Bosch suspends manufacturing operations at Bangalore and Nashik. Bosch to halt production at North India factory. Bosch suspend operations. So apparently it's, they're saying they're to adjust production to meet the demand for products and to avoid unnecessary buildup of supplies.
Of inventory, yeah. Inventory. So, the consumer is unwinding. The consumer is pulling back. And, you know, most of these economies are consumer driven. So the consumer is not there. The consumer is over indebted. All the big themes are still in place. I mean, you had the debt saturation point in 2007, 2008, and you have this unwinding. So David McWilliams is talking about Ireland. He's talking about the fact that essentially the bond market is doing well and the bond market is functioning. But, you know, he says it's a two-tier market where the bond market is servicing the international banking interests. It's not reflective of the domestic market. The domestic market is crumbling. And he says, look, we have a two-tier economy here, a two-speed economy, where bankers are using Ireland as a place to churn some sovereign bonds to make some bucks on the fees. But it doesn't reflect the underlying economy that is in collapse, and the real estate in Ireland is still dropping.
Well, I have some numbers here. It's a David McWilliams article titled, "What's the EU's Endgame?" The headline in yesterday's Irish Independent was eye-catching. It said that half of all Irish businesses are on the verge of collapse, according to stress tests carried out by business and credit risk company VisionNet. Companies in the hospitality, construction, IT, motor, and wholesale and retail sectors are least likely to survive. Added to this is the news that five companies went bust every day this month. This news came on the day that the central bank pronounced that lending to the private sector continues to slide. On an annual basis, lending fell by 3.7%, with mortgage lending down by 2.2% and lending for consumption and other purposes down 7.9%. Credit for companies also declined, down by 2.9%. Loans to companies fell by $399 million during June, following a decrease of $338 million in May. So there's also more evidence that house prices continue to fall, news that long-term unemployment has reached 200,000, and 4 out of every 10 people on the dole have been out of a job for over a year.
Mm-hmm. And Yeah, and the real estate market continues to fall. You know, when we were there over the past few years, everyone is still very bullish on real estate, even though they're just losing their shirt on real estate. But it's always like, this is the bottom, this is the bottom. Well, it hasn't bottomed out yet. The economy is shrinking. He's talking about the fact that the country has lost its sovereignty. That just becomes a backwater for bond traders in Brussels and Berlin. And, you know, our point when we were there was that if you lose your economic sovereignty, you lose your sovereignty. When the president of the company of the country says, well, we've lost our economic sovereignty and we're working to get it back. Okay, what about, what was it, 1916? Was that the year of Irish independence? So, okay, it's gone. I mean, you're not independent anymore. You've lost that battle. You were independent. And as of what your president just said, you've lost your sovereignty, then you're no longer independent. So that was a short time of independence, but it's over now. And if you want to be independent, you're going to have to fight for independence all over again. That means fighting the bankers. That means the war that was fought for independence will be refought against bankers, and they're ready to fight. You know, this hedge fund guy out in Long Island, Green, he's saying, look, I'm a billionaire. I'm a hedge fund manager. I'm worried about the rabble rousing and the people out there that I've stolen money from, and we're hunkering down. We'll do whatever it takes to defend our position. So they're getting ready for the big throwdown.
The Irish independence was 1921, I think. And the Jeff Green, he's actually not a hedge fund manager. He's a property guy. He made money on property, which was even more fraudulent-based wealth coming from there. This is an entire Ponzi scheme. It was run as a Ponzi scheme and a fraud scheme. So, he's sitting out there terrified of people.
All right, they're hunkering down. They're getting ready to defend their positions. And, you know, I was reading that rents in New York are going down. People are giving away first month free rent. People are giving away closing costs for stuff. I mean, the rents are down. The same week, you hear that the developer is selling a property that they acquired 15 years ago for $5 million, and they put another $5 million in development into it. They're selling it for $100 million. So, again, this global group of bankers, they are profiting. I mean, this will be a place for someone to hunker down and fight the war against the unwashed scrubs that have had their entire economy and sovereignty stolen.
What was the bank? Was it Wells Fargo that Chris Whalen said was getting in big to the corporate property sector in the commercial property sector in New York? Whereas, like, all the local banks, like J.P. Morgan, had completely withdrawn. So another classic sign to the very end of a bubble.
They're turning mortgages, like in the subprime days, for a quick fee. And if they get in trouble, they get a bailout. So there's no risk to them.
Well, that's right. So what else is going on out there? Let's go to The Guardian. I noticed, like, despite all this stuff happening, you're very distracted in the UK. All the newspapers, of course, you have the Olympic stuff, but, you know, everybody here is apparently just so concerned more about Syrians today. They have zero memory of Libyans and what's going on there. They don't seem to care at all about there. They just want war. They've got to go protect some people. The next people they're going to want to protect is Iran. Here's all these bust nations, broke, bankrupt nations, and war is apparently the answer. They're certainly, hoping for a way out of this Great Depression.
Oh, yeah. Well, remember Iraq? Remember that? That was a country that was on the front pages for a while. Yeah. Now it's firmly in control of the five or six biggest oil companies. Yeah. Blood for Oil, of course, that was an easy one. Libya is another oil play. Syria is, you've got some interests going on there. I guess Syria is kind of the last the last Mideast country that has some kind of interesting conflicts going on, right? And it's lining up where you've got, it's a proxy war, right? It's back to U.S. and Russia, right?
Yeah, a bit of that, of course, in the U.S. with France, Turkey, U.K. on the other side. But it is really interesting. The interesting thing is to read, say, The Guardian, the so-called liberal papers are the ones that agitate most for these sort of humanitarian wars. And they interview or talk to people, you know, who are speaking in Arabic. They have groups of guys behind them in Arabic, waving flags, talking about stuff. And you have to go to places like the Angry Arab, who speaks Arabic, and he'll say, like, they're basically Al-Qaeda. They're waving Al-Qaeda flags, and they're saying jihad language to the journalists, but the journalists don't understand what it is. And they keep on saying, he'll point to their actual words, like the New York Times will use, saying they're mostly secular or mostly, you know, non-extremists. They're alleging that it's all somehow a secular war. But as Charles Glass on Democracy Now! Was saying, is the guys who are secular, the ones who have been imprisoned for decades, the ones who were in Syria fighting for a true, you know, peaceful uprising, say like what happened in Cairo, you know, we didn't arm the guys in Tahrir Square. They stood up to a dictator and forced them out because there was genuine public uprising against them. Here, they're creating conflict in order to create the massacres that inevitably happen in a war zone. Look what happens in Iraq all the time. Look what happens in Afghanistan. There's massacres all the time because, you know, American soldiers get shot at and they drop a bomb on those people and they kill hundreds of people at a time. So, you know, and then it depends on whether or not the media looks at that, the death of all these people, and says, oh, look, a massacre. We need to go protect these people. Obviously, as you said, they don't care about Iraq. Iraq has had its bloodiest few weeks in the past few years. Are you seeing any Brits out in the street going, we need to go help these people. We need to go reinvade to protect these people? No, because it's Al-Qaeda doing the bombing right now, and we're with Al-Qaeda in Syria.
They don't protect the people in Aurora, Colorado from massacres. Did they go after Warner Brothers? That is mostly responsible for that massacre? No, of course not, because it's good business. Massacres are good business. And the U.S. used to have this reputation for, you know, Ozzie and Harriet, who, you know, ice cream and stuff and whatever. But, you know, it's just a pit like all these other countries. And
well, so this whole inflation deflation debate is apparently roaring up again. Mish on his site this morning has preposterous falsehoods from Gary North regarding the inflation deflation debate.
Wow.
So Gary North apparently wrote yesterday a blog titled "Why the Deflationist Argument is Wrong in Both Theory and Historical Fact." He said an inflationist is someone who believes that price inflation is the result of two things, monetary inflation and central bank policy. A deflationist, and Mish believes he's specifically talking about Mish, is someone who believes that deflation is inevitable despite monetary inflation and central bank policy. No inflationist says that price inflation is inevitable. Every deflationist says that price deflation is inevitable. And, Mish tears him apart. Sustained price deflation is certainly not inevitable, nor is price deflation inevitable in the short term either. Since I am a staunch deflationist, and since Gary North is aware of my writing, it appears he is purposely making preposterous straw man arguments just to be able to shoot them down. This is just, you know, we said this a few years ago, that, I mean, it's amazing this argument is still going on all these years later about whether we're having inflation or deflation.
Oh, yeah. And then Gary North, he's an interesting character. You know, last year I took some pot shots at him because his writing is, you know, the straw man argument. He uses it all the time. And this is what I find is true throughout this libertarian class. I mean, the argument goes like this. Yeah, there was a mass shooting in Aurora. You got to let the market figure it out. The planet's burning up from carbon emissions. Let the market figure it out. You know, they never see the fact that the market itself is completely corrupt due to negligence by these so-called libertarians. But they always use the exact same nonsensical circular argument over and over again. And Gary North does this all the time, and it was fun to take pot shots at him. But he's so intellectually bankrupt that none of his pieces make any sense. You know, he's over there at the Lou Rockwell site, and you know, again, there's no follow through in any of those libertarian arguments. They simply make straw man arguments backed up by a completely unsupportable notion that unregulated markets are self correcting, which completely discredited. It's not the case. I mean, it's just not true. But so on the inflation deflation front, Gary North is saying basically there is no such thing as deflation. And because if he recognized deflation, he would have to recognize that banks are crooked, that off-balance sheets exist, that the shadow banking system exists, that free market economics is a sham as it's currently iterated, and that his life is as an observer is invalid. So he's not going to do that. So he makes straw man arguments to defend what he believes is perpetual inflation, and the result is a train wreck.
Well, even look at that statement. Price inflation is the result of two things, according to him and other inflationists: monetary inflation and central bank policy. So he's saying price inflation. And yet, what about drought causing the price of grains to rise? What about conflict or deep water horizon disasters causing the price of oil to rise?
Well, what Mish is saying and what Steve Keen says and what others are talking about is that the inflation numbers, you have to include monetary numbers plus credit expansion, and that credit expansion causes interest rates to collapse and the currency to collapse just in equal measure that outright money creation does the same thing. Gary North does not recognize credit expansion in his definition of inflation and deflation. And that is foolish, because in an economy like the U.S. or the global economy that is made up with hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives, which is credit inflation or debt, which is 10 to 20 times bigger than the global GDP, it's quite foolish not to recognize that you are, you know, governed by this huge force called credit inflation. And the way the banking system works is that it spawns more credit inflation through, you know, this fractional reserve system. And the result is what we have now, an imploding deflationary economy. There are pockets of price appreciation in things that are being artificially boosted by government subsidies. So the price of education is going up because the government subsidizes those things. The price of corn is still relatively, the price of healthcare is up because the government subsidizes healthcare. Price of food, okay, it's interesting because you've got man-made global warming and climate change, which is now affecting prices with the huge drought. Okay, that's a drought-induced inflation on prices. That's a kind of a whole different. Ecological economics. The Nobel Prize isn't yet to be awarded for that, so it's not even recognized. The environmental economics is on the fringe. Nobody even talks about it yet. They will, of course, within 5 years. But the overall, the biggest dominant trend is deflation, as we point out. The demand for stuff is collapsing. The bond markets are collapsing. The banks' balance sheets are collapsing. All monetary stimulus is not working at all. Greece is collapsing. Ireland is collapsing. Spain, Italy, collapsing. The U.S. is collapsing. The U.S. dollar is world reserve currency, so it masks the effect for a time being, but that too is falling apart.
Well, let's go over some more blog stuff, because Mish then goes on to say, you know, from there, related, of course, is the big gold and precious metals investor side of this inflation-deflation debate. And he notes that Bill Murphy sent out an email with "gold hype sounds like grade school chant," where he was like, "I heard from three people," but he doesn't name the sources, that "I've been jumping up and down for fireworks to happen in August. We shall see." He thinks that gold is now going to go ballistic in August because he heard this from three people.
Uh-huh.
But of course, that, you know, you can't predict markets. Who are these three people that say it's going to go suddenly ballistic out of nowhere, right? But Mish says five reasons to own gold. Gold is a nice insurance policy against a currency crisis, and I think one is coming. When or what country kicks things off of that crisis, I don't know, but I suspect it's more likely to be the Japan, Italy, or some other country in Europe as opposed to the U.S. Gold, number two, gold, contrary to popular myth, is actually a great hedge against deflation in the senior currency, clearly the U.S. dollar. Three, physical gold is a currency that is not someone else's liability. Four, central banks, not just the Fed, have been pouring on the liquidity as the global economy moves from one crisis to another. Odds strongly favor more coordinated central bank liquidity moves, and those liquidity moves tend to benefit gold in the long haul. And finally, five, should the world return to a gold standard with 100% gold-backed dollar, $1,600 an ounce will really look like an extreme bargain.
Well, I'll give you somebody who's saying gold is going to skyrocket in August, and I'll tell you his reasons. Mm-hmm. And that's James Turk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he talks about something which I hadn't seen before, which I would describe as virtual backwardation.
Huh.
Now, in backwardation, and let's say silver, for example, the price of buying silver down at the local coin shop is $60 or $70 an ounce, or let's call it, you know, $40 an ounce. The price of silver in the futures market is $28 an ounce. So the price of the spot price is higher than the futures price. That's called backwardation. It shows that the demand in the short term is forcing prices in the short term higher than in the long term, which is the backwards of what a normal market would be doing. That places a value on time. So the time, the value in the further months would be higher than the short months. Now, virtual backwardation has to do with gold as a currency. And if you look at gold as a currency, it doesn't pay any interest. And whereas currencies like the Swiss franc are paying a negative interest. So what you end up with is virtual backwardation. Because even though gold is not paying any interest, and that typically, you know, versus other currencies that would pay some interest, that would make it in contango. The fact that these currencies are now going into negative territory, you have virtual backwardation because gold pays zero interest, which is higher than a negative interest. And so typically, historically, whenever these metals go into backwardation, remember, the spurt of silver from 26 to 50 was preceded by a sharp backwardation in silver. We haven't seen it in gold at all over the past 5 to 10 years. Now, if you look at these interest rates, the way they're trending, we do have it in gold. And so for that reason, we could see a significant now move of gold out of this trading range that's been in place for 12 months. And what would the next move be? The next move would be a breakout to the 2,000 to 2,200 range, and we'll be at a different paradigm for gold. Of course, silver then would bust through 50, and then once it gets through 50 overhead resistance, which it's had for 40 years. I think it's going to trade very quickly up to 60 from there because it's been bound by that $50 ceiling for 40 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, patience. This is supposed to, I guess, September, October, during the marriage season in India, is supposed to be, you know, a good time that I guess gold is supposed to rise and stuff. But I'm also surprised, actually, that the dollar has never got anywhere near where it went during the 2008 crisis. I'm just surprised about how weak it's actually been during the past 3 years or so.
Well, the technical chart, if you will, is the inverse of gold. So the dollar is failing to break out on the upside, just like gold failed to break down on the downside. Yeah. And so these two things have always been trading really in opposition to each other. And that breakout in gold should come with a breakdown in the dollar. The euro, which has been talked about for a year or two now as being the weak link in the global currency market and is going to break up and Greece is going to leave. Okay, we've never said that. That's never been the issue. The euro was never at risk of disintegrating. And so I'm in the kind of the Jim Rickards camp on that. There's never been any reason to think that Germany would let the euro break up, and it's their call. That's been clear for a couple of years now. They run the show. Ireland is now a vassal state of Germany. Greece is a vassal state of Germany. Germany is rising as a very, very powerful country. If China falls apart, the only real superpower will be Germany. And the euro is the Deutsche Mark, on a big European imperial scale. The dollar, however, not so good.
Well, Berlusconi's newspaper, I think Il Giornale, they had a front page yesterday, the Fourth Reich, calling Germany the Fourth Reich. I believe there was somebody we know who said that first.
Right. Well, I never understood why 10-20 years ago people were so passive about Germany, saying, well, you know, they're pacifists, they're greens, they've learned their lesson. But when the Euro was project got together, it reunified East and West Germany. That's like putting, you know, nitroglycerin together with a shaky wheelbarrow. You're talking about the reunification of the most aggressive, imperial-minded group of engineers and technicians of the past 200 years. Now, who's done it like Germany? Nobody. You know, so they're back.
Well, Margaret Thatcher did try to stop it. She did all she could to keep the Berlin Wall from falling at that, you know, before they then claimed ownership of it.
Yeah, right. Okay. She was the child of the Blitz. You know, she has fond memories of what happens when you put the Teutonic genie comes out of the bottle. Now, again, everyone's looking at what's happening in the Mideast. You know, the U.S. is in a quagmire in Afghanistan. As you pointed out last week, Vladimir Putin very cheekily told NATO that they should stay in Afghanistan and finish what they started. Of course, that's what would be his comment, because this is where traditionally empires go to die, including the Soviet Union. So, you know, they're just flailing about nonsensically. Meanwhile, Germany, you know, the employment numbers are great. Their entitlement programs, which of course were invented by Bismarck, the whole idea of Social Security is a German invention. These are all in surplus. The Social Security and all of the entitlement programs are in surplus. Employment is great. The economy is growing. They're all family-owned businesses. They're not publicly traded Ponzi schemes like in the U.S. So they're ready to assume the crown.
Well, you know, we spoke of Gary North and strawmen, and Carl Denninger has this, what I thought was a really good piece, being, you know, very principled about what libertarianism is, because Carl Denninger considers himself a libertarian, and more obfuscation by Bloomberg and others on trade. And it's talking about, Bloomberg says, oh, you know, this reports that Ralph Lauren outsourced production of the Olympics uniforms to China has U.S. lawmakers in a lather. And then they're, you know, it should, they've introduced a new bill, Team USA Made in America Act. And then Bloomberg disses this, saying, you know, we need free markets, blah, blah, blah. You can't intervene. So Carl Denninger says, really, outsourcing is pointless? Then why do companies do it? That simple. They do it because there's no such thing as free trade. It is actually slavery and abuse of people over there that they're getting, that they're able to get away with. U.S. laws also prohibit dumping toxic waste into the air and water instead of spending millions of dollars to properly dispose of that waste. Sweatshops cannot exist for long in a competitive market because labor, if it is free to organize, as management is free to offer low wages, will eventually strike and force balance to be restored. It is only through the initiation of force, and now that's an important concept in libertarianism, there's supposed to be no initiation of force, that such conditions can exist. A free people will not work under these conditions. They will choose better. A free people will not permit the poisoning of their land and water, killing them and their children. They will demand proper environmental safeguards and put in place a government that prosecutes those who harm others. It is only through lying and abject fraud that that offshoring can exist like this in the U.S. as well. Without salaries sufficient to purchase Apple's products, there is no Apple. By offshoring the production of Chinese sweatshops, destroying the labor base here in the United States, Apple will be cutting its own throat, but for the frauds ladled upon us by banks with the explicit cooperation of our Congress and its deficit spending, yet another initiation of force. It is often said that people borrow of their own free will, but that is not always true. No lender intentionally makes losing loans in total. When you act in a way that appears to intentionally make money losing loans and then force government to bail you out, lest Armageddon ensue, there is no free will involved. You've imposed your loss on other people through the initiation of force. So he's looking at all the initiations of force, including environmental catastrophes, which, you know, when you spoke to Peter Schiff, he said there's no such thing, essentially. That's initiating force against somebody who has not, who did not want this environmental disaster inflicted upon them.
Right. So Bloomberg is wrong when he says it's a free market that we have to respect. And that's what I'm talking about. It's the fake libertarian argument of stating a straw man argument and then saying, well, the free market will solve it. And as Denninger points out, the manufacturer of these Olympic uniforms is who exactly? It's the government of China. Mm. It's the government of China is making these uniforms. Okay, that's not a free market, is it? It's the government. It's the government. So Bloomberg is arguing for government manufacturing control. Is that what the libertarians are standing up for? Is that what they represent? Government control, government manufacturing, government factories? It's not a free market. The use of force argument is a good one because, as Denninger points out here, it can be applied throughout the whole supply chain. There's use of force. The libertarianism is like Christianity in some ways in that it's an ideal that is an interesting ideal, but it's not achieved. But people believe, they become fundamentalists in this regard and believe that they are the messenger of what their interpretation of the ideal is, but that invariably means an ideological warping of through their minds, and then they create straw man arguments, and then they go, well, it's what's what the Bible said. Mm. Well, the Bible never said that. Or Bloomberg says, well, we should manufacture these because that's what the free market doctrine says. No, not at all. You're completely wrong. You're misquoting the entire thing. You're off base. You're not even in the right stadium. You're completely, completely wrong. But people just accept it because it's shorthand for an ideological dogma that is inculcated into the brain by massive repetition in mainstream media that, again, is not libertarian because there's no competition.
Yeah, the straw man argument they always use to the environmental catastrophes is Goldman Sachs has carbon credits. It has nothing to do with the facts on the ground. They're just creating a straw man over there that has nothing to do with it. And Carl Denninger goes on, but what then is the excuse of the libertarians? They cannot hide behind so-called free markets and capitalism. It is not capitalism when someone shoves a gun up your nose and demands your labor. It is not capitalism when someone evades the cost of production of goods by dumping poisons in your air and drinking water, literally sickening and killing the people. It is not capitalism when one intentionally makes bad loans and inflates the supply of currency and credit with the explicit knowledge that this will force prices higher to beyond the consumer's ability to pay, and then force the consequences of that behavior by force upon others through dumping it on the people via government. This practice has risen to the level of public embarrassment. We are well beyond the point at which one can argue that so-called globalism is about anything other than initiation of force. As public anger over pollution and working conditions has risen in China, proof that the workers view these practices as initiation of force. The firm is looking to move facilities to Indonesia, much like locusts strip a field to the bare stalks and then move on to the next.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a powerful piece. You know, it's exactly what I've been, you know, trying to put into words in terms of libertarianism, fake libertarians. And so he's done a good job in putting that all together. And this is from a guy who is mostly, you know, I think, associated with the other side of the argument. So it's a good. What's the title of that?
It's called "More Obfuscation by Bloomberg and Others on Trade." Well, I think of him kind of as like Glenn Greenwald on civil liberties, civil rights, that, you know, Greenwald is, he's obviously more of a Democrat in terms of his sensibility, but he's principled and he doesn't care if his side of the team is, you know, he doesn't abide by dogma when the facts on the ground are different. And this is what he's saying here is like, he's looking at all the blind spots and the straw men that they're putting up, the libertarians, and refusing to address. And he does mention the banks. Like, again, a lot of the libertarians will skirt around the issue of banking fraud, as you said on our show recently. And he says, when financial institutions are able to effectively counterfeit the national currency by issuing unbacked credit, they force downward everyone's standard of living by destroying the purchasing power of the common man. These same institutions then offer loans so you can afford to buy what has gone up in price. The price increased because the denominator increased in the form of excess credit, which the banks intentionally created. They know you ultimately can't pay when they make the loan, however, so they turn to government force by dumping those loans on the taxpayer. Example, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, student loan programs, now government-backed, to evade the consequences, i.e. bankruptcy, of their willful behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right, and he's talking again about credit expansion, which is what this inflation debate and the Gary North does not recognize credit expansion in his definition of how the economy works, even though that credit expansion is the predominant force driving this economy.
But he's also pointing out something that libertarians you see over and over refuse to admit. They refuse to admit that banks play any part in this credit expansion. They blame the victims. They say that you didn't need to take that student loan. You didn't need to take that housing loan. You didn't need to take those loans. You didn't need to take that credit. But he's, you know, Carl Denninger is suggesting that it's through force that they've created this situation where they're the ones that have devalued the currency, driving up prices, driving, and also at the same time, through force, initiation mm-hmm. of force, driven down labor wages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is people need to eat and they do whatever it is to survive.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, this whole use of force, and it's completely invisible and not talked about, because for the reason you were saying, people, they, when they talk about the subprime crisis, they say, "Oh, well, the people took on those loans. They're the issue. They're the ones that were doing it." But the loans are forced on them, and you see this use of force throughout the entire economy. So it's not a libertarian economy; it's a forced, state-controlled, forced labor economy, or forced consumption, as I have called it in the past. It's not so much forced labor as forced consumption.
Yeah, and a lot of that forced consumption is financed not only through slave labor in China, but also through the massive initiation of force in the Middle East. We cannot have any of that without the energy, to be the resources being taken from the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. And that's a very brutal genocidal use and initiation of force that is backing all of this.
Right. And so typically there is a backlash to all this, but the language is very misleading. So people still in the biggest economies don't see it as being victimized by state-controlled force. So they believe that they're just having infinite choice, as in the consumer wonderland that has ups and downs in this beautiful market-driven economy of libertarian paradise. And there's just some days you win, some days you lose.
Well, you said there's usually some sort of resistance eventually, but, you know, there are so many straw men out there. You know, people are focused on the wrong thing. You know, you can't talk about the Middle East unless people will screech. They screech out of control on Twitter or something that you can't be against this because then you're for the dictator. You want to murder people. You know, it's they're out of control in terms of these. They just don't know. They can't see the big picture, the whole thing. You know, that the initiation of force, for example, everywhere here, and they just choose to overlook it because a straw man has been presented to them.
Well, people want to believe their lives are meaningful in some way. And if they can believe that they're doing something to save innocent women and children in Syria, then they'll buy into that, even though they're buying into the forced consumption model and brute force of the state destroying the global economy and ecology. That's an externality that they don't think about. In the short term, they see the crying baby on TV and they say, "We have to stop the crying baby." And because they want to feel, at least for a minute in time, that their lives are not just being consumers like pigs at the trough. But the fact is that without it's forced consumption, and people are valid to the extent that they can consume. They're not valid as savers. They're not valid as workers. They're not valid as thinkers. They're only valid as consumers. So when they consume, then they're recognized by the state as having value. When they stop consuming, then they're ignored.
Now, this headline just came through on Twitter. Now, notice the public response to these sort of headlines. Who is it that tells them to screech and run around, you know, yelling and help, help those people over there when one headline hits and not the other? So here, car bomb explodes near military police offices in Libyan capital of Tripoli. Mm-hmm. Nobody, not one single person will care about it. No Guardian journalist will say, "We need to go save these people from these car bombs. The evil person who set off this car bomb." Because, well, BP's already in there. BP has those oil contracts. Mm-hmm. We don't care about it. And we've already got that. We don't need it.
No, because the human brain can only, you know, juggle one or two or three items at most at a time. Mm-hmm. And today, the crying baby is in Syria. So that's all the human brain can handle, you know. So that's the Syrian crying baby. So the most people have carrying around in their brain an image of a crying baby in some zone that's being, there's a coup d'etat by corporatists and they're being suckered into supporting the corporations. Or, and then the second image they carry around is of some kitty cat video from YouTube that they can't get out of their brain. And then the third image is, you know, what they had for lunch the day before. And they're thinking about, what am I going to have for lunch today? And that's pretty much the sum total of human brain activity. Now, tomorrow, the Syrian baby shot will be replaced by the Iranian baby shot. And everyone, during their lunch break and kitty cat YouTube views, will be wondering, what's happening to that Iranian baby? I gotta help it. Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, but it also helps. I suppose a lot of it has to do with emasculation. And a lot of, you know, you see that on YouTube, it's mostly men hanging out all day, apparently, who don't have jobs. And, you know, but they feel that their righteous indignation could at least inflict their, you know, they can kill somebody indirectly and slaughter a nation and take out dictators. And they seem to have a nationalistic sort of patriotic fervor that it's somehow making them more manly, that some guys in Vegas have pressed a button that dropped a drone in somebody's house. So I think it's probably part of what we were just talking about in terms of all the jobs being outsourced, that that it reaches. Well, you saw it in Nazi Germany. It was.
I would say that the young men who push buttons to kill people, they're a free-floating group that could be used by either side. You know, like the hedge fund industry. They're a free-floating private kind of contractors, or they're just testosterone-driven, blindly sexually driven, you know, violent people that can be used, manipulated by either side. The problem of, as I see it, is the fake sanctity of motherhood. This is what trips liberals up. The conservatives don't care about motherhood. The conservatives would kill moms for a nickel. They don't care. But the liberals, of course, they have the sanctity of motherhood, and they will never organize themselves, because within the liberal caste, there will always be somebody concerned about their newborn baby. And so there's never going to get the economies of scale. There's no shock left. There is no critical mass of dissent. That it comes around infrequently, every 200 years or so. But for all the rest of the time, it's the right-wing sociopaths who don't care. But occasionally, though, there is the right. I mean, it invariably, it's up to the women. It was the grandmothers in Venezuela who took to the streets. It was the women, the fishmongering women in France who started the revolution. You know, you need the left-wing mothers have to revolt, because the guys will never do it, because they'll go to any war at any time for any reason. They don't care. They just want to kill and hang out with hookers. They don't care. It's the mothers. Mothers must revolt. So are the mothers in America ready to revolt? No.
Okay, well, with that, it's about the end of the show now, Max Kaiser, and this has been The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM in London. Make sure you tune in next week, because that is our, let me see, make sure I'm saying, oh no, we have two more episodes before we go on vacation, so you better stay tuned.
Bye, y'all.